Welcome back. I'm Joe Donahue with Alan Chartok. Once again, Alan and I will have a roundtable debrief where we zoom in for a closer look at what's happening in the world. Dr. Brian Fallon is director of the Tick-Borne Disease Research Center at Columbia University. He will be speaking on Friday at 7 p.m. at Columbia Green Community College in Hudson, New York, presented by the Cornell Cooperative Extension. Dr. Brian Fallon is internationally renowned for his work on the neurologic and neuropsychiatric aspects of Lyme disease. Dr. Fallon's work has also included diagnostics and treatment studies. The Columbia University Tick-Borne Disease Research Center was established as the first academic research center in the country to focus on multiple discipline approach to chronic Lyme disease. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Brian Fallon to the roundtable this morning. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Very nice to have you with us. I do understand neurologic. Tell me about neuropsychiatric and how that impacts Lyme disease.
Good question. Neurologic refers to the classic meningitis and cranial nerve palsy that people recognize as being one of the signs of Lyme disease. Less well recognized is that Lyme disease can cause what I call neuropsychiatric problems, such as disturbances of cognition, where a person might have problems with short-term memory, verbal fluency, their speed of thinking might be slower, and generally what they describe it as a brain fog. So that's the more common neuropsychiatric manifestation of Lyme disease. Sometimes people experience significant depression or anxiety, and rarely they might experience psychotic symptoms as well. So that would be a rare manifestation, but that can occur as well.
When you think about the overall, just in what you'll be talking about at Columbia Green Community College, what do you think that it's important people to know of what is happening in this world of Lyme disease research, of what we know now and the question marks that still remain?
Well, I think one of the big things going on is that there's a growing awareness that Lyme disease is a spreading problem. The incidence of Lyme disease 2 years ago was described by the CDC as 300,000 newly diagnosed cases each year, you know, indicating that it's a massive problem in this country. For example, various states have noticed, and in New York State in particular, Lyme disease was first initially described in Long Island and Westchester County and slowly creeped up New York State up into the Saratoga County's areas, and going westward as well, and it's now in Vermont, and it's in western Massachusetts. So the geographic spread is extensive. So Lyme disease, number one, is recognized as a big infectious disease problem, a vector-borne disease problem. Another issue that comes with Lyme disease that people have struggled with is we know how to treat early Lyme disease when patients present with a rash, and most people do extremely well when they get the 2 or 3 weeks of oral antibiotics. The question is, how do you help patients with persistent symptoms or when they relapse with their symptoms? So that's an ongoing struggle in the research community. I can say that there's been some exciting new findings going on regarding why patients might have persistent symptoms. There's very interesting animal research that has gone on recently showing and documenting that the mice or the monkeys that have been studied, for example, can have infection that persists even after a standard course of antibiotics. And so that's important because what that demonstrates is that what the patients have been complaining about, perhaps, that they have relapsing symptoms maybe because the infection has returned, does in fact have an animal model that supports what they're hypothesizing is true. So that is important because it allows researchers then to pursue that question. What's going on in humans? Is it possible that they have persistent infection? Or is it a post-infectious problem where the immune system has gone awry and is causing problems on its own, triggered by the original Lyme infection, but no longer the infection is active? So these are all questions that are active in research, and I'll be talking about that at the conference tomorrow.
Dr. Allen here. I wanted to ask you a question. Keeping it simple, before we go into some of the more esoteric parts of this, what are you telling everybody to do? Because I live in Great Barrington, we're here in Albany, the very areas you've just talked about, what should we be doing?
Well, the most important thing is to do careful tick checks in Lyme season. So at this time of the year, in April, May, June, July, when the ticks are, the nymphal ticks, the small ticks are the most active, it's really important to do tick checks on yourself after you go outside, like once a day. Have a spouse do it, check your children, because we know well from the research that if you remove the tick within 24 to 48 hours, the likelihood of its transmitting an infection is extraordinarily low.
And what are we looking for? In other words, it's been described as the size of an eraser in some cases, been described as a pencil point, just dot. What are we looking for in our bodies?
It's the size of a poppy seed, so it's tiny. And that's why it's often missed, because it's so small. So it's like a freckle. Now, once it's on your body for longer than a day or two, it starts to expand because it's basically feeding on your blood, and it starts to bloat, so it looks like a tiny raisin after a while. Mm. So you can recognize it then because it's protruding from your skin. But initially, it can be hard to recognize, and you actually don't feel it bite because when it bites, it injects a numbing substance.
Can it get through your clothes? So in other words, if you put your socks on over your pants and go out to mow the lawn, can it get through all of that?
That's terrific. If you put socks on over your pants, it's not going to get through your clothes. Now, you can actually do an extra measure of protection. And there are sprays, what are called acaricides, that you can put on your clothes that will actually kill the spirochete, kill the ticks as well as repel the ticks. So that can be very beneficial, and those sprays actually, the solution stays on your clothes through something like 40 washes, so that can be helpful. So there are a lot of things, and also homeowners can do a lot in their home environment. So if they keep their lawns free of brush, free of leaves, that can do a tremendous amount. They can also spray their lawns if they wish, and that reduces the tick density in the lawns tremendously. If they have a jungle gym for the children, they should not put it in the woods. They should put it in the well away from the woods on the lawn, so that the kids are not exposed to the brushy areas that the ticks love to reside in.
Mice and voles, should we kill them one way or the other?
Well, if you could, get rid of all the mice and voles and shrews and chipmunks, I suppose you'd have vastly fewer carriers of the Lyme spirochete, and the ticks feed on those, and that's how they get the infection. But that's unrealistic, so that's not going to happen.
You know, so much of what many of us know about Lyme disease, unless we have someone who, which of course those numbers are rising, of someone that we know who has it, but so often we're introduced to it through our pets. And
that's correct.
I'm curious as to how like a comparison, how apples to apples is that comparison. My dog tested positive for Lyme disease last year and was treated with a whole course of antibiotics, and then I'm told that probably now for the rest of the dog's life he'll test positive. I assume that, is that the same with humans?
Exactly. That's a very important point, which is that just like dogs, when you get infected, the blood test will stay positive for a number of years. So that, and that's true for humans as well as animals. And that's one of the major problems with the Lyme tests, is they don't tell you whether the infection is still present. All they tell you is that you've been previously exposed.
Are there, when we talk about research and what's coming in this world of research, is that one of the things I assume that's being worked on, is to clarify those tests?
Well, you bet. If you think about the massive rise of Lyme disease testing in the United States, you can think that companies are trying as hard as they can to develop the next best Lyme test. And I'm confident that in another 2 or 3 years we'll have some excellent new Lyme tests on the market. So I'll be talking about some of those tests, and what's nice about some of them is that they're actually able to identify whether active infection is present.
Hmm.
When we think of our pets, you know, a rule of thumb is that if you see a flea, if you see one, there's probably a million around. Is that the same with ticks? I mean, if you see one, because what often happens is you let the dog out. I'm lucky enough to have a yellow lab. Alan has a Westie that's white, so you know those are easier to see
that's
when
good.
You see.
Yeah.
Right? You have a light colored animal; they're much easier to see when the ticks are there. But if not, you know, going through that process of if you see one. Is it just something that's hopped on, and if you take care of it, you've taken care of it?
For your pet?
Yeah. Well, I guess even for you, too.
Well, how do you know? You know, how do you know? Because you've taken off one doesn't mean there aren't others that have lodged on your dog and they hold on for dear life, the ticks. I recently was in Long Island over Christmas time, and my dog came back with 8 embedded ticks. It's incredible. At Christmas time, and we didn't realize that the dog had gotten bitten because we didn't anticipate that it would occur in December. But it can, of course. And it was only a week later when we started feeling these bumps on the dog and we started pulling off the deer ticks that we realized that wow, these ticks are present all year long.
There has been some controversy in your field, of course, you know much more about this than we do, about the tests which find Lyme disease but don't always look for all the other diseases that come along with the same ticks. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. There are other infections, microbes that the ticks carry that can cause other diseases. So, for example, one of those diseases is babesiosis. And babesiosis is a malaria-like illness that can cause pretty dramatic fevers as well as many Lyme-like symptoms with really significant fatigue and maybe muscle pains. It can cause night sweats, sometimes headaches. And if a person is treated for Lyme disease and doesn't get better and still is having really profound fatigue, for example, one really needs to test for the possibility of babesiosis. Another similar co-infection carried by the ticks is infection that causes anaplasmosis. And that can cause also a very high fever, as high as, let's say, 103, 104, 105, such that the person is so sick that they get rushed to the emergency room. So most emergency room doctors are well aware in Lyme endemic areas that this is something to rule out immediately and to put the person on doxycycline, which is a very effective treatment for anaplasmosis. In vulnerable people, it could actually lead to death. But fortunately, if you catch it early and treat it early, people generally do very well. Another infection is a virus, actually, Powassan virus, which is a tick-borne virus which can cause an encephalitis that can be in certain situations cause death as well. So there are some very serious infections caused by the microbes in the ticks.
Another
infection that is also recently discovered is Borrelia miyamotoi in the ticks, and that causes a Lyme-like illness, but the current testing will actually test negative for that particular microbe. I'm sure that in the next year we'll have a test that will be able to detect the Borrelia miyamotoi. But the good news is, the bad news is that you don't get rashes with the that particular infection, so maybe hard to detect because the first symptoms might be flu-like symptoms, and you might not think of tick-borne illness. But the good news is that it does also respond to the standard antibiotics for Lyme.
Doctor, if you scratch, we had a letter on this, if you scratch what you think is just an itch, and it turns out to be the tick, there's some theory that this will make the tick regurgitate the poison into the body. Is there anything to that?
Well, it is true that you don't want to agitate the tick when you're removing it. So if you're constantly scratching the area where the tick is, it is possible that the tick might be prone to inject its bodily fluids into the bloodstream, and therefore you'd be more likely to get whatever is inside that tick. So, for example, you don't want to remove a tick by burning it off with a match, let's say, right, which some people do. Really what you want to do is you just want to put some tweezers underneath the head of the tick and pull it out, and the tick will in fact come out. But you don't want to squeeze the belly of the tick.
Dr. Brian Fallon is director of the Tick-Borne Disease Research Center at Columbia University. He'll be speaking Friday night, 7 o'clock. That's tomorrow night, Columbia Green Community College. Dr. Fallon, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.